Okay, while you might be ready for some leftover Thanksgiving turkey soup and hearty bread and butter, pull up a chair and join us for Cultivated Audio November 2023. Paul Silty was raised on a crop and dairy farm, and his book, How Soil Works, is legendary at this point. And Robert Kremer's career in soil research and soil health gives weight to closing the door on industrial agriculture. It's a great time to think about soil, and these two men share a wealth of information. I'm Robin. Come and get it. Paul, regeneratively restoring soil is certainly what's needed for farmers and ranchers to farm and ranch profitably. Perhaps drawing from your book, How Soils Work, you can share a few key points that will bring us into understanding the mutual support system that the soil and the plants have to enrich each other.
Yes. I think it's critically important for farmers and gardeners to understand the relationship of soils to the plants that grow on them. And that has to do with the microbial population on the root surfaces. You know, the root is more or less like an intestine inside our bodies turned inside out. The intestine has microbes inside of it. In fact, we have about 4 pounds of active microbes in our intestines at any given time. And these produce the growth substances, the available nutrients that our body absorbs. In the same way, a root on its exterior has just an incredible array of bacteria and fungi and algae, actinomycetes, and other organisms that take the energy that the plant feeds it through the root to generate the growth substances, available nutrients, antibiotics, vitamins, and so forth that the plant can take up and grow profitably.
Now, when you're working with soils, are there cautions that come to mind in balancing the minerals?
Well, certainly. In fact, one method of balancing nutrients that I look to is called the Albrecht system. He was a professor at the University of Missouri for many years, and he recommended a balancing system that I believe is very good, utilizing a ratio of about 65 or so percent base saturation of calcium versus magnesium of around 12 to 15%, potassium around 5%. That is those cations in their cationic form. Sodium needs to be fairly low and hydrogen low as well. But that balance is very important in my view.
And so in order to establish what it is you need in the soil, is there a certain type of soil testing that you prefer?
Any lab that does this percent base saturation analysis is a good one. I use Perry Labs in Bowling Green, Missouri, but there are others. They're all, on the right track. Soil balance is very important, not just absolute amounts, but the balance. And, of course, you'd expect in a sandy soil with low cation exchange, you wouldn't have as high levels of the nutrients, but the balance still should be there, even as it is for a clay, high cation exchange capacity soil.
Now, when you're talking about the cationic ionic, there's an energetic balance that's going on. It's how the soil is actually using the food, which creates the energy, which creates the life. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that we need to start with the sun because that's the source of the energy that the plant uses. And actually, plants are harvesting sunlight energy.
Right.
And it's the activity of these chloroplasts, you know, in the leaves that are really the key here. If we can get these more active and capture that energy that then translates into making the plant substances, the carbohydrates initially, and then the proteins and the lipids and other things that the plant needs to grow, and also to translocate into the root system, that's what we really need to focus on. And I think that's what the farmers and gardeners need to understand, that we're in the process of capturing sunlight energy to grow our crops. We're harvesting the sun, you might say.
Yes, yes. And I know all of your extensive knowledge and research has led you into looking at and making biostimulants for the plants. Now, before we move into that, is this needed because the soil is so depleted that we're now looking at plants and ways to enhance their abilities to capture the sun and then get this process moving?
Yeah, that's a very good question because, yes, you are correct. We're dealing with a sick patient, essentially.
Yes.
You know, after decades and decades of abusing our soils, I'm speaking of especially farmers that I'm familiar with who have to, you know, make a profit to exist. Over the years, the organic matter has been depleted, and minerals as well, but especially organic matter. In my view, the organic matter is the heartbeat of the soil. Mm. It's the most important component, and we need to make sure that that is at a high level, because if it is, that will more or less forgive a lot of the problems we throw at it. And we have to do everything we can to make sure that the level of organic matter is not being depleted. Right now, even with minimum tillage efforts by many farmers, that organic matter level is still dropping. As say, for instance, here in our prairie soils in the upper Midwest, we may have started with 6 to 8% organic matter. We're down, in many cases, below 4, and it's still dropping. So that has to be attended to. That's a number one.
If farmers are turning things around and trying to do things, quote unquote, more properly, what is going to arrest that depletion and start bringing it back? What's the first thing you do?
The first thing to be done, if at all possible, is to reduce or eliminate tillage. Tillage is like a hurricane going through the soil. It disrupts the ecosystem of the soil, you know, the network of the mycorrhizae, fungi, the bacteria, and other organisms that have set up a system there, kind of like a society that we have here above ground.
Right.
Yeah, and it really is it's a very vital, active, growing system, and we ought not to disrupt that. So whatever we can do to maintain it and encourage it is extremely important. And in my field, I work with biostimulants, and they encourage the growth, especially of mycorrhizae. And I don't know if you or the people you're familiar with really understand mycorrhizae well, but they're extremely critical in the ecosystem of the soil. And they produce in the walls of the hyphae, you know, these little thread-like materials.
Yes, yes.
That they produce, those hyphae walls are what's called myoglobin. And the myoglobin is what creates the long-term, very stable organic matter in the soil, and it comprises about, on the average, around 30% of our soil organic matter. And it's very stable, and it's very important for long-term soil fertility. So biostimulants, well, at least the ones I work with, help increase the growth of these mycorrhizae. So you get an increase in this long-term stable organic matter. So that's extremely important in any of the practices that farmers or gardeners use.
Yes. Now, cover cropping is, of course, all the buzz now as part of the regenerative system. Is that something that would work the same but a lot slower, and we're needing to really give a boost at this point in time because of the degradation that has happened?
Oh, cover crops are great in the sense that they create, you know, a network of fine roots in the soil. And that's kind of like going back to a prairie system where you have always a continual cover of the ground with roots. And I think that's extremely important because the soil was never meant to be left uncovered. You know, it always needs that blanket of green and of roots. As long as they're there, the soil is protected not only from erosion, but also the replenishment of organic stores, because they're fixing carbon and they're putting their energy into the soil, and those roots are excreting that organic matter, feeding the microbes. And also when they die, those root remnants, you know, break down and add to the organic matter. So they would help reverse the depletion of organic matter, for sure.
But the biostimulants are doing that at a quicker rate. Is that what I'm understanding, or perhaps not understanding?
You are understanding right, because the biostimulants will encourage the photosynthetic activity and therefore help transmit more energy into the soil on the what we call the rhizoplane. You know, the exudates go into the soil to feed the microbes, but you're also producing a greater root mass. So you're getting benefits twofold there, more exudates and more roots. So that would indeed turn around the tendency to lose organic matter, provided that tillage is minimized or even eliminated.
So could you share an example of what you've seen in how a field will turn around once someone adopts this kind of system?
Well, there are just a number of situations I could probably describe. Of course, we're dealing now with monoculture, which is, you know, not having the rotation of crops like from alfalfa to corn to wheat and soybeans and that sort of thing. We usually, up in this part of the world, deal just with corn and soybeans in a rotation, one after the other. But what we have found in certain fields that use biostimulants versus those that don't, if you don't use a biostimulant of some sort, you will not get the increase in organic matter, whereas if you do, you will get the increase.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically a general rule. You have to get those microbes in the soil active and producing the myoglobin to increase the organic matter levels so that they'll not just be increased, but that they'll stay there. It's a hard thing to do under today's economics, you know, which encourages
right.
exploitation. Very hard.
Yeah, boy, that's it in a nutshell, encouraging exploitation. That says so much in just those two words.
Yes.
Yeah. So you just mentioned the rotation of corn to soybeans and back and forth and back and forth. Aren't those days over? Are we seeing the end of that? I mean, I know economics are one thing, but is there a way that you've been able to encourage farmers to get out of that just mono system of one crop to the other and then back again? Is there a way to financially make it viable to do something different at this point in the game?
That's a very good point, a very good question. It's very difficult because the farmers are pressed economically. Most of them have to, you know, take out loans and they have to make a profit. And they're caught in this syndrome of corn, soybeans, in this part of the world, the whole corn belt, essentially, which is a huge area of most fertile soils in the world. And then, but the wheat growers, likewise, you know, are caught in the monoculture system. It's very hard to break out of that. And I'll tell you the main reason why that is. And that is because of the elimination of mixed farming. It used to be that around this area, all of the farmers in the early days, you know, 1900s, especially the early 1900s, milked cows.
Right.
And or at least they had some beef animals.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, the beef industry and the dairy industry is all concentrated. We have dairy farmers up here that have 10,000 cows in one operation. Or at least a couple thousand, and it's very rare to find a dairy farmer that has, you know, small herds anymore. The same is true with beef cattle. The beef are almost universally put into feedlots, so you do not have the livestock on the individual farms much anymore. And as a result, you don't have the manure to return to the land. You don't have the need for feed like alfalfa or various grasses to be grown in rotation. So the farmers go to the next viable option, which is the most profitable one and the easiest one to farm, which is corn and soybeans, or wheat after wheat in Kansas and Oklahoma. It's a very difficult position for farmers to be in, and I feel for them.
Certainly, yes. Yes.
So, you know, it's difficult.
Since you are right in the thick of things there, would you say they are seeing the writing on the wall, that they're going to have to leave fields fallow, or not fallow, but cover crop them for a season to jumpstart things?
I think farmers see this. In fact, there are some farmers that are making changes. There are some that are growing radishes, for instance, if it's warm enough in the fall after they harvest. There are soybeans, for instance, or other crops. But right around here, and I'm not saying what we have right around here is like everywhere, but here the farmers are very conscious about just surviving, and they are doing what their neighboring farmers are doing, and they have abandoned the moldboard plow, that's true, which is a very good thing. You hardly see any plowing done anymore.
Oh, bravo.
Yeah, that's a very good change. They're caught in this syndrome of corn and soybeans, at least to this point. I think they're all aware of changes that could be done, but they've got their investment in machinery, you know, their tractors, their tillage equipment, their combines, and all of the things that are needed to produce these types of crops. And to change that system over to one, say, of more cover crops, more grasses, more alfalfa, and so forth, it's extremely costly. I was talking to a friend of mine just last night. He's an excellent farmer down in northwestern Iowa, and he just bought a header for his combine, just the header, $40,000 for a 40-foot header. Machinery costs are astronomical, so the farmers have to be extremely careful about what they invest, and if they're already set up to do certain functions, to convert over is very difficult for them.
Yes, and well, I want to thank you, Paul, for seeing a need and creating this biostimulant direction so the farmers can be helped, because they are caught in this quagmire. And, you know, there are ways, I think, there are ways for people to really see the light and just making as perhaps small a shift as they possibly can in this process of hopefully cleaning things up. But tell us a little bit more about the biostimulants that you've researched and you've created. What ingredients are they? I know they are considered organic, right? It's not like you're using any chemicals or anything.
The ones we have are actually certified organic.
It's a fermentation process, and I know I'm not asking you for the recipe, obviously, it's your business, but maybe you can just give a little bit more of an overall about how they work.
Surely. The biostimulants we work with are based on very low levels of natural growth regulators. The growth regulators are not known by a lot of people because they're fairly new, but they're natural, mainly in the category of brassinosteroids. Brassinosteroids are a well-recognized class of growth regulators since about the 1980s. They're highly effective at extremely low levels. By extremely low levels, I'm saying that if you apply the recommended rate of 1 liter per hectare, which would be about 13 ounces per acre, you get only 10 milligrams of active agent per acre. That's almost nothing.
Right.
In nature, in the creation, it takes extremely little to do a lot.
Yes.
But those are triggers, and they interact with the DNA, you know, the cellular machinery, to multiply those effects as you, create the various compounds that plants produce. And they're highly effective. The other main growth regulator in those that we produce are tricontinol. It's another growth regulator, and there are some others, some vitamins as well. But these are what are triggers to photosynthesis primarily, which then translates into greater leaf growth and root growth and soil activity. I call the microbes growing in the soil on the root surfaces the stomach of the plant. It's kind of like the stomach, and this method of triggering plant growth is highly effective. In our particular research, we have data going back to 1995 when I first began working on this particular biostimulant group, and we've been researching ever since. We have over 1,000 studies at universities and various other agencies since then.
Since you do have research going back that far, is there anything that you've seen that is contraindicative to using this? The Native Americans have a philosophy of going and looking ahead 7 generations and see if it's still a good, viable system. Do you have any thoughts about that and how you've been working?
Well, yes. I have no reservations that this is the right direction, even though we don't have 7 generations, you know, to prove it.
Of course, no.
I personally have a view of the natural world,
yes,
to see how it works. And this system, I call it the symbiotic cycle of plants working with the soil. This works with all plants at all times. It's just the way plants work. So I have how many thousands of years or whatever of proof that this is the way plants work.
Right.
What we need to do is stimulate this natural system to work harder, should we say, so that plants can do their job better instead of just having to be suppressed by the practices farmers are throwing at them and with the pesticides, you know, herbicides, insecticides, and so forth, which tend to diminish the growth of these organisms in the soil, and also on plant surfaces too. I won't get into that probably unless you want me to, but there are also organisms that live on plant surfaces that are very effective.
Yes.
But if we help overcome the difficulties that these organisms and natural systems are having, then we're on the right track, and I don't think we have to wait, you know, many generations to prove that this system is right, because we're just enhancing a natural system.
Right. Are there recommendations that you make for the soil before one would start using these on their plants?
Well, we recommend that a farmer balance his soils, as we talked about earlier. You know, look at the minerals through soil testing, at least remedy the major deficiencies or imbalances. A gardener can overcome some of the deficiencies and imbalances just by adding compost or manure, and that itself will do a lot to turn around any fertility problems. That's what I would recommend, and that's what we recommend.
Do you recommend, if farmers have X amount of property and they've been doing a corn-soybean kind of rotation, if they are able to not do that on a certain portion of their property, what would your recommendation be if they could afford to leave a certain amount of acres and get it out of that rotation? What would you recommend they do?
Well, of course, they have to fit in that new crop to whatever system they're on. I mean, if it's a cash crop of some sort, that's certainly what they're usually looking for. And if it's alfalfa or if it's some grain, you know, like barley or rye or whatever, of course, they certainly need to have a market for that. But if they do, I think they'll be rewarded by breaking the cycle of the corn-soybean rotation, which is so prevalent around here, in the Corn Belt at least.
Right.
And that would certainly be a plus for the soils. And frankly, I think it would be a plus for the farmer getting out of the humdrum of just being caught in this rotation that he's now in. If I was a farmer like that, I would welcome that. Some farmers are finding that alfalfa itself, because of its great value, and it's in demand for cattle, you know, at feedlots and other places, just growing that as a cash crop is actually pretty lucrative now because the price of alfalfa is very high. I think in this area, a big round bale will sell for, $150 or more. You're getting into some pretty hefty value there, and I think for a lot of farmers, this is a viable option. It certainly is something that they can look forward to, possibly.
Yeah. Is there much communication, do you think, going on in your area? Are you seeing more and more farmers communicating this sort of thing to each other?
I think right in this area, I'm a little out of touch with the farmers in that ballpark. What I do know is that they're probably not telling you a lot of what they know, because there's a lot of peer pressure to continue, you know, the current regime.
Right.
I'm sure they're aware of alternatives to what they're doing, but they're just not able or willing, you know, to break out of the habit they're in. I don't blame them for that.
Certainly.
But I certainly think that the whole area, the whole country, frankly, would be better off if we had a different system. I'll tell you just a little bit about my view about how things should move, if I may.
Please, yes.
The trend over the last, at least since World War II, and even before, has been bigger and bigger farmers and fewer farmers. We got rid of the horses and then went to tractors. And since then, the farmers have been getting bigger and bigger, and now they're getting gigantic. 2,000 or 3,000 acre farm here is nothing anymore. Some of them are, you know, 25,000 acres. I work in Ukraine. We had farms over 1,000,000 acres. That is, you know, one farming company, but one entity. I believe that this country would be much better off, and people would be much better off, if we increased the number of farmers.
Right.
And got people on the land so that they could take care of it better, manage it more intensively, and produce their own food where they can. And I think that would strengthen communities and strengthen the nation.
Absolutely, yes. And the industrializing of agriculture has really brought it into such a mechanized view, and that shows up in science. Science certainly has its place, and you're a living example of that. But farming is a biological system, and it isn't mechanized. You can say, okay, put this amount of calcium and this amount of that, and each field will react a little bit differently. Not to say that the existing formulas are incorrect, but it's a constant life cycle, so it's constantly changing and moving and growing. And I don't know if there's anything to be said from you about that, and perhaps you just said it in the sense that if more people were connected to the land, it would just help turn things around just by doing that.
Yes, you say it very well. I couldn't agree more that plants and agriculture are a biological process, and we should not conflict with that. But we are. Essentially, farming has become a conduit for raw materials going into the, the commodity market and export market and so forth, the grain marketing. Grain marketing is a huge business controlled by very few corporations. And I don't think this is the way forward to the strongest nation, the strongest families, you know, family development, to get people on the land and experience what it means to learn responsibility and to work and to produce, you know, from the soil, which should be the focus of our lifestyles.
Yes.
In the sense that, I was just glancing at a book I have. It's called All New Wealth Comes from the Soil.
Mm.
It was written by Carl Wilkin back in 1957. Using statistics from the U.S. government, he showed that all new wealth truly comes from the soil, looking at the government's own figures.
Right.
And by multiplying the amount of crops, and also he included mining and fisheries, by five, you get your gross national product, essentially, showing how important it is for farmers to produce and for people to appreciate that and prosper on the land and for the whole nation to prosper as a result.
Back in my hippie days, I guess I had heard that this man from California was running for president and he was going to take all of the military out of Europe and bring them back and plant fruit trees in America. and I thought, okay, you've got my vote. That makes more sense than anything I've heard in a while.
Yeah, I just want to add one little bit.
Yes.
Essentially, what I see is this has been on my mind, especially of late. The farmer has become basically a producer for industry. And he's caught in that syndrome. And you look around here, the big combines have been running here these last days, combining soybeans, about to go into corn. And they're just feeding that system, and they're not feeding a system that our nation was originally designed to do, which is to have families living, as Thomas Jefferson said, having land, at least a little of their own, to produce for their families.
Right.
And strengthen our nation.
Yeah. Do you see any red flags as this regenerative agriculture movement gets itself established? So many theories come and go, and practices come and go, in vogue and not in vogue. And I'm wondering if, from where you stand...
That's a difficult question to answer, I think, in the sense that I think that's the way we need to go. I don't see any options, frankly.
Mm.
If we want to have a strong country and viable families, make for better health of people. I mean, if we don't have good health and raise highly nutritious crops, and whether it's in the garden or in the field, we're going in the wrong direction. So I don't really see any impediments to moving forward towards regenerative or sustainable agriculture. You could use different words to describe, what
sure.
we're really talking about.
Right, yeah.
But I would say we should remove any flags that might stop us along the way.
Perfect.
And yes. go full bent in this direction.
Yes.
Because we're, how should I say it, kind of running out of time. We need to turn things at a faster rate in that direction towards, I think, more people on the land. And that would give more stability. Our people, we need smaller cities and bigger countryside. I'll put it that way.
That certainly would be nice. Now, one last question for you, Paul. We've been speaking all around this, of course, but the mutualism that exists in the natural world is really almost beyond belief when you start looking at it. I'm wondering what one thing comes to your mind right now that represents this beauty and the poetry of life to you?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I think talking about the mutualism of plants with soils, for instance, which is what I dwelt upon in my book, How Soils Work, it's that, we have the concept of love that we hold dear to us. That is frankly how crops and soils work in their optimum. And one is feeding upon the other. One is helping the other. There's no downside. Just like when you talk about a business transaction, both parties need to be benefited. In the soil, you have the plants being benefited by the sunlight energy being transmitted down into the root zone, feeding those microbes feeding the plant. And that's just a beautiful synergism, or I call it a mutualism, that is in operation right in front of our eyes.
Right.
If we can look. Now, you can't see it because it's underground, but it's there, and I would call that love. And we need to have more of that in this world.
Bob, to get us current, please share the thrust of your career as professor and researcher.
Well, yes, it goes back quite a ways. I started out professionally 40 years ago with the USDA Agricultural Research Service as a microbiologist. I started in weed science, where I had quite an unusual project, which was to try to find a way to stop the germination of weed seeds in soil, in other words, a weed seed bank, using practices that might stimulate certain microorganisms to attack seeds and maybe decompose them and before they ever had a chance to germinate, or at least damage their germination potential. And it was a very difficult project that lasted quite a few years. Then I just kind of evolved into biological control with microorganisms and combined with insects, depending on the type of weed that was the target. Also had some experience with pesticide fates. This was before crops that were genetically engineered to tolerate certain herbicides. This was when we were applying very high rates of chemicals to the soil, and we were not only getting some buildup of these residues in soil, but we were getting accelerated degradation where there were so many organisms that would adapt to these high quantities that the actual pest control would fail. So that was interesting, and we moved along. Then I became interested in a couple of topics, which at the time was called soil quality, which we all know now as soil health. In on that early on with some research on that area, so much that some folks didn't really understand that concept, and for a while I was pretty well working on my own, kind of paralleling John Duran and University of Nebraska, the early pioneers in that field. I had kept that on for quite a while. I was interested in cover crops and reducing herbicide use and other pesticides as well. So that's been going on for 30 years in, as far as my research projects have gone. And in addition to that, genetically modified crops came along, primarily the ones that were tolerant to Roundup or glyphosate. I did a lot of work with that originally because we knew that glyphosate would cause build up of certain microorganisms in the rhizosphere of certain crops. So we thought that perhaps we could use that in another manner to control root pathogens on crops. We were looking at a beneficial way of using that particular compound. But as it turns out, you know, we discovered that a lot of potential pathogenic fungi would build up on the roots of soybean and corn that were tolerant to glyphosate and eventually could cause problems. So I've been working on that for quite a while, and it was something that was controversial, that the industrial people and the apologists for the herbicide industry were trying to say that our research was not complete, or they would just try to dismiss it, obviously for apparent reasons of, you know, profitability or ease of management with this. So it was very interesting time period. Not that I feel that I have to defend that research, but that I stand by, and now it is being confirmed or validated by other researchers from various parts of the world. Looking at that, I've been thinking about, you know, how do you transition from a conventional system into an alternative or even organic system and take away or minimize the effects of glyphosate that still might be persistent in the soil, which of course is something else that we've been told that doesn't happen, but we have evidence that it does.
Yes, and that's actually a main question that I wanted to ask you today, because most everyone is working with soil that's been compromised, and whether it's through the pesticides and the chemicals or just plain not being cared for, left barren or something like that. What do you see happening when the microbial communities establish themselves to work with what's going on, which was the chemical and the glyphosate? What is that looking like to transform out of that as far as the microbial world is concerned?
Right. You mean, say, transitioning from a very chemical-dependent system into one that's more, let's say, regenerative or ecological?
Yes.
Well, it just so happens that I did have a project in Iowa where that's exactly what this farmer wanted to do. He noticed that he was getting weed buildup from resistant weeds, and his corn and soybean yields were decreasing over time. So part of that project was to look at the soil microbiome or the soil microbial community from the standpoint of the impacts of all these practices over the years, or what were the characteristics of the community. And it was very interesting because we could find that there were quite a few decreases in the abundances of certain groups of these microorganisms in the soil due to the consistent use of chemicals. And also, you know, they were not adding any cover cropping practices between seasons. So there was a reduced organic matter in the soil as well, which was surprising for me, looking at Iowa soils at that time. Also, that would be an example of a reduction in the structural diversity in the microbiome. Then the other point was there was a reduction in a lot of the biological activity that was mediated by these microorganisms, which would be a reduction in functional diversity. And when we follow that, looking at certain enzymes in the soil that drive important processes such as decomposition and nutrient transformations and these sorts of things. So basically, what we found in these fields, and they were using a minimum cultivation or minimum tillage.
Right.
So they weren't completely transferred to no tillage. So, the baseline that we started with was pretty degraded from the standpoint of the biology in those soils.
How did that affect the fungi-bacteria ratio?
Yeah, it affected quite a bit because the fungi were lower, because another practice that was going on was that they would actually harvest some of the corn stover for bedding. So if you don't have a lot of that crude material, like crop residues to start with, the fungi are going to be searching for substrates or material to digest and break down for their own energy. So there were not as many fungi in that fungi to bacteria ratio. So that was decreased. And the other component of the fungal community would be the mycorrhizae. And the mycorrhizae were reduced as well. And, of course, this was compared to some fields that were managed in a more holistic manner, which are kind of difficult to find sometimes. But
right.
We managed to make those comparisons.
Yeah. So how do you recommend getting that fungal community into a good balance with bacteria?
Well, it's a matter of maintaining and managing these crop residues when they're, say after harvest, and also not to bale all the stover that is on the ground. You can remove about 40% of that and still maintain an adequate level of residues on the soil surface that will still nurture the fungal community. You know, that's one way. The other is to reduce tillage, of course, try to cut that back, get into at least, if you can't do no-till, at least do mulch-till or something like that. And then they were feeding the stover and using it as bedding, encouraged them to return that material back to the soil as a compost or a manure to build organic matter up. And in that way, one can widen the carbon-nitrogen ratio of the type of organic matter that's going back to the soil. That will stimulate the fungal community, and that way you'll get a better fungus to bacterial ratio built up.
Yes. So does the soil organic carbon quality, I'm sure that's just all part and parcel with all of this about what you're speaking.
Yes, for sure. We did measure things like active carbon and water extractable organic carbon. What happens there is active carbon is a reflection of not only the input, let's say, from the living crop plants, because a lot of it is what we call labile or readily available, carbon sloughing off the roots or even coming in as soluble root exudates. That is connected to the microbial community, because the microbial community not only relies on that for its nutrition, but it also helps in creating the active carbon during the decomposition process of the younger material, the residues that is entering into the soil environment. So that does play a very important factor. And in fact, I believe that measurement of active carbon or water-soluble carbon is a quicker index to see how well organic matter is building up or organic carbon is building up in the soil than to rely on the old umbrella measurement of soil organic matter, because that particular measurement takes quite a few years to build up to where it's detectable.
So is this carbon test readily available? Is it a usual test that people are doing? Or?
Well, it's more prevalent now, because with some of the labs around the country that focus on, let's say, soil health indicators, active carbon is a readily accepted soil health indicator that represents not only the microbial component, but also the chemical component in the soil, that a lot of these soil health test labs do have that option that you can have that measured, and they'll include that in the report.
Is there a certain test that you either rely on or feel like holds a really good indication for what you would need to do to go forward?
I can't really point at one single test. I do believe that the active carbon is very important, and also the different broad groups of microorganisms in the soil. One should try to get a total microbial biomass or microbial biomass carbon in the soil, because that will give you an idea of the abundance of the microbial community in the soil, as well as how much carbon is being trapped by the microbes as well, which is an indicator of carbon sequestration, and also the amount that could be potentially available as that carbon is turned over by these microorganisms.
Right, yes. It must have been so amazing to be doing research through all these years that you're talking about, where all of these pesticides and everything really came into vogue, and then, oh, we're going to take them out of vogue now. And the system is so intertwined. The work you've been doing is just brilliant, because it is. You follow one lead, and it leads you back, and it leads you forward at the same time, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's been an interesting period. And, of course, it seems like one thing that's consistent is that when a problem is found with these synthetic chemical inputs, the solution is to develop another one and start another problem.
Right.
And at least some of the conventional farmers are understanding that, well, maybe some of these chemicals can be reduced if they're able to put in, let's say, soil health type practices. That would include things like cover crops, because some of these crops can nurture the microorganisms in the soil that will bring these degraders back to get rid of these chemicals once they have already done their thing, to kill off the weeds or whatever the intent was.
Yes.
But then oftentimes we come up with another problem. Now we're using three herbicides instead of one to control certain weeds.
Right. Well, is there a caution using what would be considered an organic biostimulant? Is there a potential 20 years down the road where we might feel like today, oh, well, this is good because this biostimulant is feeding the plant, so it's helping with yields, and it's also going into the roots and feeding the soil and bringing more life and energy into the soil? And yet, are we going to find 20 years down the road, oh, that was really pushing things too fast? What's your thinking there?
Yes, I've also screened probably 30 to 40 biostimulants in the last 20 years. My first concern is, does it really work? Do these biostimulants work? And there are some out there that are very effective. The ones that are effective that can be used consistently over time, as far as problems in the future coming up with those, I'm sure there's several possibilities, but, perhaps some of these might change some biological function in the soil that, let's say, that might cause maybe an overabundance of carbon take-up or whatever that might affect performance of the plant. That's kind of stretching that a little bit. There could be some natural mutations going on as well, especially if these biostimulants are based on living organisms. If they're based on, let's say, a prebiotic where there's no organisms, but there are metabolites and things from algae and all this kind of extractions that are going on to make up the components of these biostimulants, there may be some problems with that. Probably one of the biggest concerns I would think of is there's a lot of biostimulants that have a lot of unknown compounds in it. Mm. I've worked with one that, ran the chemistry on their product, and they show over 400 compounds in that product, and they only know that, maybe 10 or 12 that are really having an effect, a favorable effect on the plant. But what are the other 300 and some compounds doing? Could they be counteracting the effect of, let's say, some of these other plant growth promoting products that are in that product? That would be my biggest concern at this point, until they can get all that identified and tell us what you're actually putting on your crop.
Yes.
That could be problematic.
Yes. Now, Bob, are those other ingredients that you're talking about, the unknowns, are they there because they have to come part and parcel with the ingredients they do know about, or are they just something they're adding because?
No, they're not adding it purposely. Some of these biostimulants, they go way back into the early part of the 20th century, where some of these scientists were taking mixed cultures of bacteria, primarily bacteria. They would put this on a particular plant or whatever, and they'd get a very positive response. And so the idea was, well, let's just add everything that's out of a fermentation tank. In other words, the vessel where these...
Yes.
It's like rhizobium, you know, they're kind of where they're mass-produced, and bottle it and spray it. So they really had no idea what was in there, but the fact that they used these unaltered culture broth or cultured liquids, whatever was in there went into the bottle that the farmer used. So it's like you say, it's part of the process. It's not that they intentionally added 300 or 400 organic components.
Yeah, and what kind of mood was the farmer in that day? I mean, who knows how deeply all of these little influences reach, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the other thing about the biostimulant industry, that it's relied on testimonials for so many years that if one farmer had good luck with it, well, the other farmer was going to try it also, regardless of what was in the product.
Right. Yes. Bob, I'd love to hear what you would say to someone who is monocropping corn and soybeans. So many in the Midwest are caught up in this loop. And I know you certainly are making suggestions to people that come to see you. It's such a big deal, literally, for them to step out of what they've known or their families have known for generations. And yet the writing is really on the wall, isn't it? Monocropping isn't the best thing to do, and there's something else to be done here.
Well, that's certainly true. And it's problematic because we have so many that are into the industrial type agriculture mode, which includes having to farm a large acreage. You know, 1,000 acres is hardly anything these days, it seems.
Right.
And then you have these farmers that really have to hustle from planting to harvest, and that's their frame of mind. Even though they may wish to employ some new practices that will at least protect the soil, they don't seem to have the time to do it. So it's a matter of management. I usually try to mention that without really irritating them about that. you know, there's something to be said about rotations, but it's got to be more than just corn and soybean, because anymore, there's hardly a benefit to it anymore, according to what we're seeing anyway, some of the work we're doing now. Soybeans tend to be pretty hard on soil. They don't have much of a root system, and even though they fix nitrogen, they are not a very abundant nitrogen fixer. Corn, on the other hand, has a much better root system, and it contributes a little bit more to the soil. So I encourage, let's look at some longer rotations, which I know the problem there is the overall problem of profit. What else can I plant that I can make some money off of? You know, there for a while when wheat was high, we were even growing some wheat out here in Missouri that could be rotated into the corn-soybean cycle. That one doesn't get a lot of response. You know, some guys are figuring out how to incorporate cover crops. I think if we just go back and look at that, I think here we're far enough south that even by the end of October, if they can get in some cover crops after, say, corn or soybeans, it will really help with the soil conservation. You know, we've always had a high erosion rate here in the Midwest with these silt loam soils that we have. And to let that bear over winter is really harming the soil, even if you have a little bit of residue out that.
Sure.
You know, I'd also suggest some organic amendments, if they can do it, some manures or compost, that kind of thing. Some guys are actually doing biochar to a limited extent. That's a rather expensive amendment, but it does have some effect on the biology and maintaining organic carbon in the soil. You know, I remember when I was on the farm, we would run livestock after, especially corn harvest, but hardly anyone does that anymore because livestock production has been concentrated.
And in saying that, I'm sure a livestock person would appreciate being able to run their cattle or have their cattle graze or other types of livestock graze on their property. And an outgrowth of that would be so much more community among the ranchers and farmers. A really good thing, ultimately, I think.
Oh, yeah, it would. You know, look, you look at some of the rural communities we have, they've been devastated by the trend towards large acreage farming because some farmers have gone and bought up all the small farms around and consolidated them. And those folks, if they don't go to town, they go somewhere else. And it really hurts the rural economy. So there are some that can lease their fields out during the fall to cattle grazers or even sheep. But the other thing you have to contend with is if you don't own your land, what does the landowner want? And that, I think, is a driving factor where we don't see cover crops or integrated livestock because the landowner wants his land to look clean or however they want to manage it themselves rather than the farmer.
You know, Bob, there are so many mysteries, especially to me, because I know so little. But what about for you when you step out of a lab and stand in a field? What strikes you?
Primarily what's growing out there in the field. I like to see this diversity. We really get seeing this field and fields of corn or soybean is pretty blasé after a while. I like to think that some guys who are progressive out there, they know where their erosive spots are in the field and they have that nicely set off in grass waterways. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that I helped with this fellow in Iowa, got him to put in some waterways. He really had some gullies in his field. You're not giving up that much area. Plus, as runoff goes through these waterways, that kind of builds up the microbial community and the root systems, solid root systems that are in those waterways. And it doesn't have to be just, say, something like fescue. I mean, you can have native plants in there and peas and grasses and all that. And that's where these degrading bacteria and fungi are located. You know, any of the pesticides that are in the runoff that runs through there, they have a chance to break down when they encounter these microbes. And we showed that in Iowa, where you know, we had about 200 parts per billion of glyphosate coming through at the entrance from the neighbor across the fence, and then track that all the way to the end of the waterway where it goes into a ditch. Well, we reduced the glyphosate content in that water by about 52%, which is pretty significant.
Definitely, yes.
So I like to see. Features like that in the landscape that is going to help not only soil health, but also water quality and overall beneficial insect populations, the pollinators and the seed feeding insects that are on the soil surface. Because that's where you really begin to see an integrated, holistic system, whether you want to call it agroecological farming or regenerative agriculture.
Right.
There is a place for that, and we're going to need that because it's going to eventually affect the health of the crops we're growing and the health of the food that we prepare from what we harvest.
Yes, let's make food more our medicine again.
Yes, as I read in a book by, I think it was Bob Quinn out there in Montana, Feed the World acronym is so old now, we really need to nourish the world.
Yeah, well said. Well, Bob, thank you so much for your time today, but thank you for your career. I mean, Missouri has, boy, there's quite a legacy there of professors and soil and plant research that has gone on in Missouri. There's something in the water there, and hopefully it's more than glyphosate.
Yeah. Hope we can overcome that.
Yeah. Many thanks to Paul Silty and Robert Kremer. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. And thanks to you for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.